again, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to the latest edition of the Opening Bell podcast with me, Alex Steedman, and Matt Christie. Loads going on in the boxing world, plenty of big news lines as well. We're recording on the morning of Wednesday, the 24th of April. Spring sunshine is in the air, and it's a new beginning for Christie, and I suppose it's a new start for the Opening Bell podcast as well. Some of you may have heard last night via Twitter that Matt is moving on from being editor of Boxing News, a kind of heritage position, and one that's been a big part of his life for several years. How are you feeling?
I actually feel really good today. I was really emotional at various points yesterday. So yesterday, the Tuesday, was the last issue for me, the last press day. I kind of felt it yesterday. But today, I feel like I've got a spring in my step, very much looking forward to the future. It was the biggest honour of my life to be the editor of Boxing News. I'll never forget that message that we got where somebody says I bang on about it a bit too much and I'll probably go down the chip shop and mention it to them when I'm ordering my fish and chips. But it is a great honour and I was very proud of it. And I'm so glad that I managed to do that. I was a little boy who loved boxing. And when I was 9 or 10 years old, I would be surrounded by boxing magazines, of which many were Boxing News. And in the middle, I would have a table and I would sit there with my stool and I would have an A4 notebook and I would try to create my own boxing magazines. And if you'd have told that very shy little 10-year-old what he would grow up to do, he would have been over the moon. And to say that I've achieved my ambition to not only write for Boxing News, but to take it one step further and be the editor, is something that I think I should be proud of. And I am. And everything that I did while representing that brand was for that brand. And I must say, I've had so many messages on Twitter. I just haven't been through them all. Initially, when I made the announcement, I went out with my wife and we had a chat and a meal and a couple of glasses of wine. And I started to look through some of the messages and it's just so overwhelming. It's so touching. But my point is that the word integrity is used a lot and being a brave journalist. I did that because of who I was representing. That was Boxing News's duty. That wasn't my duty. That was Boxing News's duty. And I always did my utmost to represent Boxing News and pay my respect to all the years that had come before, all the editors that had come before, John Murray, who founded it with the mission statement, essentially, because it was called Boxing, not Boxing News when it began. And the mission statement was, boxing will stand for a good, clean sport. And that's really been my mantra. I'm not saying I'm now going to turn into a dastardly, villainous journalist now that I've left Boxing News, but I never once took that position lightly. Never once forgot how important Boxing News is in the sport and what it is there to do. And I did that job with an awful lot of pride.
That and those should be the key words for the incoming editor of that heritage magazine. And I suppose the two questions that I'm kind of duty bound to ask, Matt, first of all, why now?
As much as it is a dream job, and I'm sure a lot of people will, from the outside looking in, go, this is, wow, look at him. He's the editor of Boxing News. He gets to interview the boxers. He gets to go to whichever fights he wants to. And there is that. That is great. That is such a privilege. And I can never be, I can't be more grateful to those boxers for what they do. But it's also a hard job, and it's not necessarily the workflow. There's an awful lot of work involved in putting that magazine together, particularly when you start talking about websites and social media channels and everything else that you need to do. But there's a weight of responsibility on your shoulders. And I would say that pretty much every editor, particularly over the last 20, 30 years or so, will be able to empathize with this, is that once the novelty has worn off, you regularly have days where you're asking yourself why you're doing it. You're picking up the phone, and you're talking to an irate promoter or an irate representative of a promoter who are grumbling, or grumbling is probably not quite strong enough a word for some of the conversations I've had over the years. How dare you give that show 2 stars, for example? Well, I didn't. I wasn't there, but I trust the journalist that was there who felt that was a 2-star show. Anyway, so you get that. You also get some horrific calls where you hear about people that have passed away. You hear about boxers that you know and have a lot of affection for that perhaps are no longer in the public eye and they're struggling. You have people calling you, asking you why you haven't put an obituary in the magazine. How dare you? When we didn't even know that they'd passed. There's very often a presumption that all the boxing news that is floating in the air somehow magically lands on my lap. So although I loved my job, it would be untrue to say I loved every moment of it. And probably over the last few years, I have been thinking, well, what am I going to do next? What there's got to be more than this. Surely I'm not going to do this until the day that I die. It's been a difficult decision to make. It wasn't a rushed decision. And I think the thankless nature of the job became more pronounced over the last 12 months. And ultimately, I felt that now was the time to do it. I still adore boxing. I love boxing. I hope people will know that largely what I have written and how I've conducted myself is with the health of the sport in mind. I want nothing but the best for the sport. But very simply, there had to come a time when I said goodbye. And now was the right time to do it.
And let's hope the incoming editor, Mark Butcher, and the ID team behind Boxing News share Matt's passion, integrity and enthusiasm for the job going forward. We wish them well. The second question has to be the one that many people were asking me on the back of the news late last night, was what does this now mean for the Opening Bell podcast? Well, essentially, very little. We go on. We move on. The big news is that the feed that we use, that will no longer be ours. So you will have to, if you're a regular follower of this, it won't automatically download next week. There will be something else that comes in its place. So you will have to do a search again for the Opening Bell podcast. It will come up again with a picture of me and Matt without any of the Boxing News logos. So just do a search, follow, subscribe as you normally do, but just do it again between this week's pod and the start of next week. It will be up and running in the next few days. As I say, we're recording on Wednesday the 24th. In the next few days, the new feed will be up and running. All you have to do to continue to listen to us and support us ongoing is to go and resubscribe, refollow, and then it automatically will download each and every week. So please do that. The other thing I would ask you is to follow us on our social channels, which we're going to ramp up and use more regularly, via Twitter, which is at Opening Bell Pod. That's at Opening Bell Pod on Twitter X. And Facebook and Instagram, which we're going to start using more regularly going forward, they're both the same. They are The Opening Bell Pod. The Opening Bell Pod. That's Facebook and Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with us the old-fashioned way, please do that. The email address has been up and running for some time now, and that is theopeningbellpodcast@gmail.com. That's The Opening Bell Podcast at gmail.com. But we have big plans for the pod, and this is a fresh start for us to make it, Matt, bigger and better.
When you said the old-fashioned way, I thought you were going to start giving out our home addresses then. people sending pigeons round or letters or something. Yeah, I mean, we love doing this podcast, don't we? and we've always wondered what we could do with it. And here we go. Yeah, it'd be great if the people that have followed us and listened to us over the years come with us. We'll be doing very much the same sort of things, hopefully more things, different things. But largely, I think why people like this podcast, that will continue. So yeah, come with us, folks. Please make it special.
So make sure you look for the Opening Bell podcast on your usual, whether it's wherever it is you get it, whether it's, you know, iTunes, Apple, whether it's Spotify, Amazon, wherever you download week on week, just go back, refollow, resubscribe in the next few days or at the start of next week, and you will get it on a weekly basis. And final word on this, there were loads of lovely messages last night, both for the pod and particularly, more deservedly, for Matt. But the one that chimed with me and I liked was Steve Hunt's message. Thanks, Steve, for getting in touch. He says, what do Matt Christie, Tom Baker and Roger Moore have in common? When you reach a certain age, you have certain figures that are important to you, your favourite Doctor Who, your favourite Bond, and for me, my favourite boxing news editor. That was thanks to Steve Hunt. Steve, I agree completely. I'm Tom Baker, I'm Roger Moore, and I'm Matt Christie. We're in complete agreement on all three of those. That was one of the many, many, many lovely messages. News coming through, Matt.
Yeah. Hang on a minute. That was what you just mentioned, Steve Hunt there. That message that I, when I read that this morning, nearly made me cry, actually, that particular one. So thanks a lot, Steve. And on that, Steve was someone that sent me an article a little while ago, and I don't think he'd had anything published before. And he's since contributed some fantastic historical pieces, and I'm delighted to say that he's recently secured a book deal for a book on 1980s heavyweights, which I haven't read yet, but I'm very much looking forward to. And also, for Steve, he's just started his own podcast called the Boxing Movie Podcast, which he admits is rather niche, but I think the first episode is out there now, so go and give that a listen. Thanks a lot, Steve. The kind words mean an awful lot.
Oh, fantastic. Look forward to that book. 1980s heavyweights, my goodness me. That is boxing porn for Matt Christie, isn't it? Let's talk about the news lines coming through. I could have mentioned this, 10 days ago, Matt. It kind of slipped through the net, but Boots Ennis to Matchroom and DAZN, big signing for them.
It is a big sign. It's a huge signing. It's a statement of intent. I think Matchroom were on Boots' trail for quite a while, and they thought something might happen 18 months, 2 years ago, but they managed to secure his services. Boots Ennis, of course, is close with Andy Cruz. Andy Cruz has spoken very highly about how Matchroom have handled him, how good Eddie Hearn has been for his development thus far, and Ennis is making that move. I think it's a really good move for all parties involved. Everybody knows how good Boots Ennis is, and whatever your opinion, your personal opinion on Eddie Hearn and Matchroom, there's no denying that they're very good boxing promoters, and I'm sure they'll work in perfect harmony together.
Cody Crowley, who's relatively high, I think, in the IBF rankings, is the mooted opponent. Dates and details, TBC, but Boots Ennis, maybe his first fight for Matchroom DAZN, will be Cody Crowley. That's to be confirmed. Yesterday, Matt, last night, we got news filtering through from Sky and Boxer that Chris Billam-Smith is going to rematch Richard Rieckpoort, defend his Cruiserweight World title middle of June at Selhurst Park. Crystal Palace celebrating, I think, 100 years at that venue, so it's something of a centenary. 15th of June, CBS against Rieckpoort. Fantastic that fight that's been discussed and mooted and teased and tantalised for such a long time, it seems, is finally in place. I suppose boxing fans will wonder, you know, maybe it's timing, it's venues, you know, the venues that you can actually hammer down and get that are suitable. But CBS having to travel to defend his world title, maybe he won't mind. It's a big venue. It's a big opportunity.
It's a curious choice of venue. Boxer have been known to do this, to not always use the conventional arenas or stadiums, and this most certainly isn't one that's known for hosting its boxing. I'm sure that Chris Billam-Smith will take thousands and thousands of supporters with him, and I would imagine at that time of year, outdoors, that's going to be a heck of an occasion. I really like that fight. It's why I can't pick a winner. You can look at the first fight. The first fight was really close, but you could look at the first fight and go, well, Riakpor got the better of him that time. Therefore, he's going to do it again. I think you can make a strong argument that Billam-Smith has improved an awful lot since that first encounter. You can also make an argument that Riakpor, we haven't yet seen the best of him, and this will bring out the best of him. But as we say over and over and over again, when a fight is announced, if you can't pick the winner immediately, then that's the start, really. That's the first box ticked. So we hope that they continue to tick further boxes as they go along. Some of the build-up already has been good fun. It's kind of good-natured. So, I'm looking forward to that one.
We will preview that in 5 or 6 weeks' time, that particular fight. That'll come up pretty quickly. I'm being teased for the start of August, Matt. Tim Zhu against Virgil Ortiz. Now, Ortiz has got a fight coming up, I think, this weekend against Thomas Delarmy. So he's got to come through that victorious and unscathed. But Zhu kind of out in the frying pan into the fire against Virgil Ortiz. That's an interesting one.
I think it's admirable from Tim Zhu. I think what it also shows is that his handlers, his matchmakers, his management team, his trainer, and crucially Zhu himself, is not suffering from a psychological hangover from that upset loss to Sebastian Fundora. I think in his head he's probably largely written it off as a consequence of a freak event when he had that horrific cut that most certainly interfered with his vision. And he's going back in with a really good opponent in his first fight back. Full credit to him.
Yeah, that's mooted for early August. So lots going on and plenty upcoming in the next few months. This week, we're going to talk about some big upsets. This week in history, we go back to 2001, when Lennox Lewis, unbeaten over the course of 7 or so years, bumped into Haseem Rahman. We're going to talk about that. Rahman, a 20-1 underdog, one of the biggest upsets in heavyweight history. We're talking about that this week. Ryan Garcia defeating Devin Haney wasn't quite off the same proportions, Matt. 5-1 against Garcia, but it was still an upset. And given all that we'd heard, seen, and felt from Garcia since pretty much December, we really didn't quite know what we were going to get. Where did this kind of rate in terms of the shock Richter scale in boxing for you?
I just think as a story, I don't recall anything quite like it. If you take it from the moment this fight was announced, the build up, the manic behaviour from Ryan Garcia on social media, even the weigh-in, the fight week, the spiteful, horrible things that were being said in fight week. Devin Haney's dad saying that his son was coming to kill Ryan Garcia. I didn't think that Ryan Garcia was going to win this fight. Another nod to my Nostradamus tendencies can be found in last week's podcast, where I said something along the lines of, if anybody thinks Ryan Garcia is going to win this fight, I'd like to have a word with them. Something like that. Something typically genius-like.
A deep and meaningful, I think it was it.
Yeah, because I felt that they knew something that I didn't. We even had an email, didn't we, to the podcast saying that they were exceptionally concerned. Mm. I think they work in the medical profession, and they were exceptionally concerned about how Ryan Garcia was conducting himself, and that he was showing all the signs that a breakdown is nigh. We had a letter as well. Boxing News had a letter as well that was published this week, in that he thought that he may still have a breakdown, and that this was just part of the whole process. It was a huge shock when it became apparent that Ryan Garcia had a very good chance of winning that fight. But you say that, Haney was winning an awful lot of rounds. Yet when Garcia was in full flow and that left hook, about the only thing we said last week that was worthwhile listening to was we mentioned Ryan Garcia's left hook. And that was just providing problem after problem after problem that just could not, that Haney could not get out of the way of it, could not solve it. But it's a heck of a story. Ryan Garcia has just elevated himself into the position of one of the biggest stars in the sport. I echo what people are saying, though, in their concern for him. He's almost like a car crash waiting to happen. You sense there's something awfully sticky approaching with Ryan Garcia. Whether he's telling porcupines about drinking, about drugs that he takes or not, one senses that he is going to need a lot of looking after, particularly more so now after his status has just gone borderline stratospheric with that victory and performance. The whole manner of it just screamed superstar. The way the interview afterwards, the way he stood over Devin Haney for one of the knockdowns, it was all screaming superstar to me. And I'll be really interested to see what comes next for him and if he can hold it all together. I might be doing him a disservice and I might still be... my mind might still be under the influence of all of that build-up where I just think, well, he can't possibly be okay. But I do think that people close to him need to keep an eye on him. And I did notice in the post-fight interview, there was, I'm not sure if it was Bernard Hopkins or who it was, but every now and again it was like, be cool, calm down, calm down. People know what Ryan Garcia is like. But if they can keep him on the straight and narrow, or as straight and narrow as Ryan Garcia can possibly travel, that is some talent and some personality that the sport of boxing can shout about.
I think it was B-Hop who was saying to him, calm down, and he almost instantly changed his tone from stratospheric shouting carried away to actually calming down and trying to be quite sensible. And it was Lee who got in touch with us, Matt, with that email, and he said, as someone who works in healthcare and has been following Garcia's online presence over the past few weeks, Lee sent us this in the build-up to the fight, pre, not post. He's displaying all of the signs of an individual in the midst of a manic episode and is not psychologically well, said Lee. If an athlete in any other sport was presenting in this way, they would be pulled from competing, Lee felt. The fact that this fight is going ahead is a very bad look for the sport. As a fan, I want to see this fight, but as a human being, I know this fight shouldn't be happening. That was just some of what Lee said. And I think what Lee was saying kind of chimed with what we were putting out last week, Matt. And I've got to say, I'm not of the opinion that just because Ryan Garcia won the fight and won it in the manner that he did and performed in the way that he did, I'm not of the view that that suddenly negates or takes away from all of the other stuff that happened in the build-up. I'm not of that view at all, not remotely. And I think it's also really important to say, and this is not to be negative about what Ryan Garcia achieved on the night, but I think it is important to have this perspective. He won about 4 minutes of that fight. Now, they were a huge, huge 4 to 5 minutes, and they were enough to edge the fight his way or secure him a draw, depending on your point of view. I had it 1-1-12, 1-1-12, for what it's worth, and we'll go into that in a little bit. But he won significant moments of the fight. Otherwise, he was either passive or got outboxed for the majority of the rest of it. And I think it is important to have that perspective when you're considering him, what happened before the fight, and actually what happened during. Matt, but significantly, I'm not of the opinion that this even papers over the cracks, really, what he did on the night, as impressive as he was in those spurts.
I agree with you. As I say, I think people that are close to him need to get even closer. I think there's also, this was a heck of a story. It was a heck of an event. It was an exciting fight. I think purely because of those knockdowns and the lead that they were slowly but surely eroding as they were happening. There was that 11th round where it looked like Haney could have been stopped at any moment. There was the last 10, 20 seconds of the fight where Garcia is sticking his tongue out, showboating. But he also came in 3.25 pounds above the weight limit. He was the bigger fighter. We are forgiving an awful lot because, as you say, for those, when you put it in context, fleeting moments that occurred in a 36-minute fight. He said, didn't he, that it's impossible to get down to 140 pounds. I don't believe it's impossible for him to get down to 140 pounds. I'm not saying it's easy. A few days before, he was promising everybody that it was bang on weight. Then he went and weighed in, and then he was on social media saying, ha-ha, got a weight advantage. So some of it, really, you could argue, was really pushing the boundaries of boxing's already bendable rules. The fact that he managed to get the job done, though, is the story of that fight, I think.
Yeah, and the way, in truth, Matt, in those four rounds, in the first round, where he came out aggressively, much like he had against Tank Davis, in truth, with that high guard press and very aggressive, quick, almost always looking for the left hook counter. But he hurt Haney in the first, and then, of course, he hurt him quite dramatically in the 7th, 10th, and 11th. Those were the four big rounds for Garcia, where there were several moments in those four rounds where it looked like he might stop Haney, and what a statement that would have been. He came close. He looked like he was teetering on the verge of it, but couldn't quite sustain it. How much did that extra 3.25 pounds, how much are you factoring into that when you're thinking about the fight, thinking about his performance? Because let's not forget, Matt, Haney's kind of made a career of that himself, albeit making weight, but then putting on a stone 20 pounds in the aftermath.
I don't think it had a huge factor in it. I don't think it was a huge factor in what happened in the fight, in all honesty. I mean, 3.25 pounds when you are down at super lightweight, light welterweight, whatever you want to call it. It's a lot. You know, it's, people will say it, there's weight classes for a reason, and there is. And Garcia chose not to make that weight. Also, in the meantime, decided that the title that was on the line wasn't important enough for him to try and make that weight. I think Haney was caught by surprise really early with that left hand, and he was caught by surprise again in the 7th by the left hand. Whether Garcia would have been less potent with the left hand if he had drained himself to make 140 pounds is another question that we can't answer. But I think he's always been potent with that left hand, whatever he's weighed. I think it did speak of a little bit of ill discipline in the build-up. But I think another question that we need to ask is, was Devin Haney okay in there? I've seen people say that he's chinny, he couldn't take a shot. You do wonder if that is going to be one of those question marks that will hang over Devin Haney's head in much the same way that it hanged over Lennox Lewis's head, for example, hanged over Amir Khan's head, about punch resistance moving forward, even if he wins every single other fight that he has. I think we should also mention, and I think it's more common today, largely because of social media and people's opinions, is that we're probably a little bit too quick to predict greatness for certain fighters. It's not easy to be a great fighter. It's not easy to go through a career unbeaten. And really, if you go back through history, truly great fighters, there's only a handful every decade. Yet today, you could look at all of the 17 sets of world rankings And you could probably pick about 20 or 30 names where people are convinced that this fighter is going to be an all-time great. I'm not saying Devin Haney was necessarily overhyped. I think he's conducted himself really well in the ring thus far. But let's just hold off a little bit before we start saying fighters are going to be legends, the legend Devin Haney, etc. Haney, I think, for what it's worth, can come back from this. And there is every chance that this may actually, in a perverse way, be the best thing that's ever happened to him. It's how he deals with that psychologically. The fact that he was winning pretty much every moment other than when he was taking that left hand would suggest that he shouldn't have a problem finding his confidence again.
Did Haney fight the wrong fight, Matt? Or was it just the way that Garcia went about it that was the difference?
There has to be a concern from Devin Haney's point of view. I think you can forgive him the first left hand in the first round where he said he was sleeping on it. The fact that he then said he was sleeping on it again in the seventh is a concern, particularly as he admitted himself that a lot of the training was geared towards either countering or defending or getting out the way of that left hand, yet Garcia found a way to land it pretty much every time he tried to throw it.
I suppose the third part of that, I should have said, was he just hurt early and never quite recovered?
There is that argument as well, and that crossed my mind whilst watching it, was has he actually, even though he was winning rounds, he still didn't quite look like the Devin Haney that we've seen in recent fights, for example. So that is something that people don't often consider, whereas it should be obvious. You go out and you take a left hand like the left hand that Devin Haney took in the first round and then just carry on with going about your business, let alone still being in a fight. It can take a long time for the effects of that, of a punch like that, to just disappear. It doesn't. So of course he was going to be stunned, but he didn't appear to be particularly groggy rounds two through to when he got dropped in the seventh, but he didn't look quite right. So I think there is an argument for that. Therefore, you can then make the next argument that if he doesn't get caught early in a rematch, he'll win it, won't he? He'll just box Ryan Garcia's head off. But there's so many questions to ask. So if Ryan Garcia is correct when he says that perhaps his conditioning wasn't as he wanted it to be, if he goes in and has a full training camp and his head is right and everything is right, it's a heck of a spectacle, that return. We often talk about rematches. Just say, we don't need rematch clauses. We don't need a rematch after every good fight. But this is a rematch that I think is... Sorry, this is a fight that's screaming for a rematch.
And you kind of hinted at my next question. That is, what did you make of Garcia's tactics? Was it a case of, you know, that wandering onto the back foot? Was that simply because he didn't have the gas in the tank? Or was that partly factoring into, you know, trying to walk Haney onto one of his left hook counters? Was it a bit of both, or was it more of one than the other?
Well, he was asked that more or less directly straight afterwards, wasn't he? And he said something flippant like, well, I've got ADHD, I do weird things. It did appear that whether conserving energy consciously or he was picking his moments when he knew that the left hand would land, I don't know. It was a curious performance. One can now say that it was an effective performance because he won the fight. And if he knew going in that he simply didn't have the energy to be effective for 36 minutes, it's an incredible showing. If he went into that feeling that his conditioning wasn't right, that he hadn't trained quite enough, psychologically, that is stunning what he's done in there. I think in that first, what it reminded me of in that first round, but only that first round, when he wobbled Haney early, it was exactly the same sensation that I had when I was watching Carl Froch, George Groves won. When Groves came out after telling Froch exactly what he would do and then very nearly knocked Carl Froch out in the first round with the exact punches that he promised he would be able to land. And when Haney wobbled in that first round, I thought, wow, he might be able to he might be able to fulfil what appeared a wild and ludicrous promise only moments before. His performance, however, it wasn't... You could pick holes in it. The thing is, when he was in full flow, he looks brilliant when he's in full flow. He was so rarely in full flow, however. You have to question Ryan Garcia. And I still think he's still got a lot to prove, Ryan Garcia. He's still just this really curious conundrum that I don't think Saturday's fight solved. It merely added more layers to it in a funny sort of a way. But somewhere in there is a really special fighter. And again, we saw flashes. We saw flashes. But what he did, again, yet again, repeating myself, I know, but that was something else, what he did, given everything that was going on, given the chaos, given the noise. What he did to win that fight, I think, is worthy of the highest praise. Even if old school boxing trainers, boxers watching it, will say that he did so many things wrong. From the moment that that fight was announced, right through until the final bell, he was making mistakes left, right and centre. But he got the job done. And I think we're right to question his state of mind, but there is also something within him, psychologically, perhaps it just presents itself in the heat of battle, where he's got something really strong. And we questioned that a little bit last week because of his performance against Gervonta Davis. But I think I take that completely back.
Well, outwardly, he seems unstable and all over the place. But in a boxing ring, or in that boxing ring, he was as strong as he needed to be. Absolutely. And that was impressive, as was the speed and the power and the physicality that he brought to bear over Haney. In truth, Haney was just tossed around at times, wasn't he? In those four rounds in particular, 1, 7, 10 and 11. And Garcia just, not the 3 and a bit pounds, he just looked, you know, Haney comes in heavier himself, folks. You know the way he rehydrates. Garcia just looked like he was going to boss and punch him all over the place in those spurts and in those spells. Matt, I wanted to ask you about sort of Garcia's boxing relationships, because the outwardly and visibly, they look so strained, don't they, across the board. I was watching him with Derek James, and it just reminded me of watching almost all of Chris Eubank Jr.'s career, where you've got Jr. in the corner, seemingly not listening or not wanting to listen or making it look like he's not listening to whoever's in his corner. There's an element of that with Garcia and Derek James. I think there's an element of that with Garcia and everybody. It's the strained, fraught dynamic with Oscar De La Hoya. It just seems outwardly and visibly his boxing relationships are somewhat fraught and chaotic. And yet those are normally, Matt, the biggest things, the foundations in a boxer's life.
I would imagine that he's nightmarish, and I would also suggest that perhaps not always of his own making. As we say, he's a very complex individual, and of which we just see more and more of that the more that we see of him. So I would imagine trying to get him to train every day is difficult. I think the difficult thing would be to retain his attention would be difficult. The whole thing with Oscar De La Hoya, I mean, what is that about? You know, they've been going to war publicly for what feels like an eternity. And now everything's okay. I would just imagine he's quite a difficult individual to manage, to train, excuse me, to converse with at times. And I think the notion that Ryan Garcia is putting on an act we probably have to put that to one side now, because this is Ryan Garcia, it would appear, because that's an awfully long time to be acting like an idiot and to keep it up and to act like an idiot after the fight. This is Ryan Garcia, isn't it?
Yeah, that wasn't a hoax. The narrative that he'd fooled us all and then pulled it out of the bag when he needed to, I think that is bogus. It wasn't a hoax. This is just part of who he is as a person and therefore as an athlete. I mean, I tell you what, Matt, though, I mean, a bit like AJ when he left Rob McCracken, you know, as a project, as a boxing project alone, Ryan Garcia would be one of the most tantalizing around for coaches and trainers and gyms, wouldn't he? To try and make him a more rounded boxer, to add to his arsenal, as impressive as those one or two dimensional weapons are, it is somewhat one, two dimensional. He would be such a project for some of those renowned or otherwise trainers across the world, wouldn't he?
Of course. Of course he would. Of course he should. Everything about him, as I said at the start, just screams superstar. The way he looks as well. Crack, I wouldn't mind being looking like that when I was 25 years old.
I'd be absolutely deadly. I'd have been lethal. If I was mid-20s and looked like that fella, I'd have been absolutely lethal. My mouth, his looks, hello.
This is what you have to consider before being overly critical. When you look like that and you're 25 years old, the fact that he can even get himself in some sort of shape to have a fight at the highest level in boxing is borderline miraculous.
And after this, Matt, it's only going to get worse or better depending on your point of view.
We wait and see, don't we? I think the hardest job is for whoever is handling him. I would imagine that you need several people looking after Ryan Garcia on a day-to-day basis. Not looking after him, that's really disrespectful. That isn't quite what I meant. But there will be people concerned about what he's getting up to if he's left to his own devices, I'm sure of it.
Helping him, being part of his personal or professional life. And let's hope there are those people in place. Right, Matt, so what next? You know, Haney and his father and Eddie Hearn I've been talking about the rebuilding project and the future still looking bright. But for Garcia, what's the best next move for him? Is it a rematch with Haney? He mentioned Tank Davis at 144 pounds. Would he be tempted to move up towards the likes of Crawford? I think he mentioned Spence as well, but kind of moving up to welterweight and beyond.
Ultimately, I think he needs to have probably a date in his diary right now that he's working towards. I think he's one of those fighters that needs to be active. I think large periods of inactivity would not be ideal for him for reasons that we've probably explained too much. A Devin Haney rematch, for me, would make the most sense at this point. I just think that really was one of those fights where people were almost exclusively, at least after it, just saying good things about the sport. It was a huge story, and I think that it would sell and it would be appealing. Garcia's made no secret that he wants to get Tank Davis back in the ring, because he wasn't in tip-top shape going into that first fight with Tank Davis, so he wants to put that wrong right. I would be tempted to really find out if he can't make 140 anymore. I think the moment he goes to 147, he's going to struggle to make that. Even 154, he'll be saying he's struggling to make that. So I'd be really interested to see if he can get down to 140 and challenge for Devin Haney's belt. And yeah. But whatever happens now with Ryan Garcia, everybody is going to be watching him. And I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. And when I say watching him, I don't mean when he's in the ring. Whatever he's now going to be doing, given the antics of the last 7 or 8 weeks, they're going to be watching him. He's going to be under a microscope. And whether that, I can't imagine that's pleasant for anybody, however used to it one may get. So yeah, kind of kid gloves, but get him active and get him an opponent that is going to motivate him. There's just no point now kind of Ryan Garcia going off on this roadshow and fighting people that, opponents that we don't know and opponents that are not going to get his juices flowing. Let's see what Ryan Garcia can do. If it was me, I'd be Devin Haney rematch. Go and train properly, for goodness sake. Get yourself down to 140 and then we take it from there.
If you've got thoughts on that or anything else we've discussed so far, please get in touch with us, Opening Bell Pod on Twitter. That's Opening Bell Pod on Twitter. Or if you want to email, theopeningbellpodcast@gmail.com. Theopeningbellpodcast@gmail.com. And while we're at it, I should have mentioned earlier on, but it's worthwhile as saying, we are on the lookout for sponsors. If you want to be part of the Opening Bell Pod, then you can be a sponsor. In the short term, Matt and I are going to be doing this. Darren, our producer, we're going to be doing this for free. I know there are some people out there who think that podcasts should be free. I don't know why. Maybe when you're a big multi, like the BBC or Sky or BT or whoever, it comes with the territory and it's part of your kind of portfolio. That's fine. Maybe those should come free. But if you're putting the work and time that we put in every week, and you like what it is that we do, then frankly, there is absolutely no reason on earth why it should be free. And in truth, it's unsustainable that Matt and I are going to be able to do that free on an ongoing basis. We will do in the short term, but it's unsustainable that that's going to continue. So if you want to be part of that, if you want to sponsor, get involved with us, be part of the journey and the next leg of the adventure, then please get in touch with us, either Matt or I on Twitter, Opening Bell Pod on Twitter, or as I said, theopeningbellpodcast@gmail.com. And we'd love to hear from you on that score. Matt, what did you make of Sam Noakes? Did what he had to do against Ivan Mendy, the nearly 40-year-old Frenchman, who former European champion, but never really got going.
I thought Noakes was really impressive. That really, I think if you want to kind of keep the knockout run going so you can say you're 14-0 with 14 knockouts, then that may add a little bit of gloss to your record. However, I honestly believe that that was the perfect result for him. He got to go 12 rounds, probably taught himself a few things about his gas tank along the way. He looked as fresh in the 12th as he did in the first. And it was a wily old campaigner, Mendy, who somehow stood up to some horrific shots to the body that at certain moments I thought, surely he's just going to take a knee at this point. Surely this will be the one that will take the wind out of his sails. Full credit for Mendy for keep going, for refusing to take a breather, for continuing and trying to find the shots to win. But that really was validation for the matchmaker again in terms of Noakes' development. Perhaps not for an exciting fight, but in terms of Noakes' development, that was exactly the right fight to make.
Mark Chamberlain, of course, with the same kind of network set up, BT, Frank Warren, Queensbury, 14-0. He's got a big fight coming up. I don't know if they might be squeezed together further down the line. But there is an Italian called Gianluca Seglia, 34-year-old Italian, who's won, I think he's 21-4-1. He actually lost to Mendy for the European title over 12 rounds not so long ago. I think Gianluca Seglia, I think he's the mandatory for the European title. So it could be Noakes against Seglia. Might be an opportunity, Matt, to defend that title. There's a rare idea.
Yeah, why not? I mean, he's far from the finished article, isn't he? And that's what he needs. He needs the kind of fights that are going to give him some kind of education along the way. You also do, yeah, I mean, there will also be a lot more interest in Noakes if there's an opponent that we all recognise and think has got half a chance. But yeah, they're building him, and I think they're right to, because I think he's a talent.
Meanwhile, this kind of Young Guns show up in Liverpool this weekend as well. That's on DAZN, where Pat McCormack's going to be a part of that, and the McGrail boys who were both on that US bill. Was it back in December, Matt, when Peter McGrail lost spectacularly by knockout? He's on the comeback trail, Peter McGrail, against Mark Leach. That's a tough reintroduction, isn't it? And I really like his brother, Joe McGrail. His performance that night out in the States was terrific. It really put him up as a young fighter to follow. So there is some action in the UK that you can watch, streaming or otherwise, this weekend.
I think Peter McGrail going back in with someone, a fighter as good as Mark Leach, shows real courage. And again, in a similar way to what we were saying about Tim Zhu, I think that it shows that the team around him have still got a lot of faith in Peter McGrail. Peter McGrail was one of those talents that you would see as an amateur and you were convinced that he would go on to be a professional force. And I don't think there's any reason why he still can't be. I think they wanted to get the opponent that was responsible for one of the biggest upsets of last year back in, but they couldn't agree terms. And here is Mark Leach. Good fight. Had it have been made 6 months ago prior to Peter McGrail losing, I think you would still say that Mark Leach was a decent opponent for Peter McGrail at this stage of his career. So that's a decent fight. Yeah, there's a few good little trade fights on that bill in Liverpool, but Peter McGrail is the one that I'll be looking at there, because that he really needs to, if should he lose, the bottom falls out of his world. Everything changes. So, but I don't think he will. I don't think he will. He admits that he just lost a little bit of concentration. He was overconfident. He dropped the opponent twice, walked into one, and that was essentially the end of it. And I think we will see probably Peter McGrail going back up in the way that we thought he would be in his previous contest.
Yeah, unless it's a vulnerability, unless it's a technical flaw, because he had looked impressive up to that point, wasn't he? He did look really impressive. And his brother, I like a lot, Joe McGrath, he punches ferociously to head and body in the pocket, and he has got a style that I love. So, and I think fans will love as well, so keep an eye on him. Hope you love what's coming up next. It's This Week. And this week, we take you back to the 22nd of April, 2001, at Carnival City Casino in Gauteng, South Africa. Lennox Lewis unbeaten in 14 over just under 7 years since that surprise knockout to Oliver McCall in London back in 94. He was defending his two titles against 20-1 shot Hasim Rahman. There's a lot going on, Matt, in the build-up to this one. It probably now, in retrospect, maybe even at the time, there were elements at play for the upset.
You were aware of it, and it's like, you know, people sometimes dine out on a result that they got right. I've heard far too many people dine out on this one, because there was a lot of noise that Lennox Lewis wasn't quite right. I actually had a bet, and the odds I got were not 20-1. I think they were about 6-1 at the time. I think I placed the bet either on the day or the day before, but they were 6-1. But yeah, Lennox Lewis, who at this point really was still kind of battling for some appreciation. I think the fight prior to this was David Tua, and he was criticised because he went the distance. But you look back on it now, and as ever with time, reputations become enhanced as it progresses. You think, well, why on earth would he not be safety first against someone like David Tua? That, for me, is one of Lewis's more impressive performances, and he had an awful lot of them. Wasn't so easy on the eye as some of his other performances, but that was exactly the way to beat David Tua. In comes Hasim Rahman, and there is an awful lot of discontentment in the Lennox Lewis camp. Lewis is training in Las Vegas. There's people living in rented accommodation to accommodate that, to be with him in Las Vegas. And the reason he's in Las Vegas is because He's appearing in Ocean's 11 as himself in a fight with Vladimir Klitschko, which was obviously a fictional fight in the film. It's a famous story now, but Lewis didn't give himself nearly enough time to acclimatise to South Africa. When he got out there, he still seemed unfocused. He was going off to orphanages. He was going to benefit evenings for... Sorry, there was an event, wasn't there? Because I think 43 football fans in South Africa had perished a week or so before. And Lewis, one of his first things that he did when he gets to South Africa is to go to this event to pay his respects. And Manny Stewart was visibly at times irate with Lennox Lewis. The curious thing, though, if you do go back, and there is footage that you can find of Lennox Lewis in the build-up to this fight, he doesn't appear to share any of the concerns that his team around him have. He is exuding confidence, and I think he believed that all he had to do really was turn up and he would win. And Lewis, let's be clear on it, Lewis isn't someone who would have done no training whatsoever. He would have been ticking over nicely, but he wasn't nowhere near as sharp as he had looked against Tua, and it was apparent in the opening moments that he was struggling for breath. And I would say that was partly down to the altitude and partly down to his preparation. But there was so much stuff going on behind the scenes that people were aware of that, and people were lumping on Hasim Rahman to win this fight.
He'd been training in Vegas, as Matt said, to facilitate that Ocean's 11 film appearance. The film came out, I think, 6 or 7 months later at the end of 2001. And he would come in at a career high 253.5 pounds. Reports in the week and week or so leading up to the fight, that Lewis had been nearly 270 pounds when he got on the scales, albeit with his clothes on. So it was a career high heavy Lewis, who, for context, had been 242, 245 in the two fights against Holyfield a few years before, and here he was at nearly 253.5 pounds. And an extra 3,500 feet above sea level as well. He only arrived 10 or so days before the fight, not as maybe enough to acclimatise. So there was a lot going on. Add into the mix, I think, to coincide with American HBO audiences, Matt, I think it was at about 5 a.m. ring walk, first bell, South African time as well. There was an awful lot going. It was quite a heady concoction. Do you sense any of that as well with the way that Lewis actually fought through the rounds that we saw?
Yeah, I think you could see. I think you could see that. I mean, I can't remember what channel in the UK broadcast this at the time, but it wasn't. I don't think it was Sky, but I remember watching it. I remember getting up to watch it. But it wasn't clear that Rahman was going to win the fight as you were watching it at the time. But you were aware that Lewis wasn't quite right. But there was a sense that he was kind of doing just enough to win the rounds, and he might fiddle his way through. But yeah, you mentioned that with the timing of the fight, is that was just because they hadn't been there for long enough. They couldn't get their body clocks right either. They couldn't, because if the fight's going to be at 2, so they need to be training. Sorry, if the fight's going to be at 6 a.m., they need to be up doing their runs at 2, getting in peak foot, and they just couldn't do it. Lewis could not sort his body out. It's a huge lesson to learn, isn't it? You would think that someone like Lewis wouldn't have put himself in this position in the first place. But I would say that he had found contests so comfortable largely since he'd lost to Oliver McCall that you probably think everything is going to be all right. But one of the things that I've heard John Scully say an awful lot, John Scully, columnist for Boxing News, former super middleweight light heavyweight contender, currently part of Artur Beterbiev's team, also former trainer of Chad Dawson, is that he will say that you can fool yourself as a boxer that you have prepared as well as you possibly could have done while knowing that you haven't. And it is only in about the 10 minutes before you head to the ring, where your head will then just fill with doubt and tell you the truth and be, you didn't do all your runs. You didn't, you haven't done enough sparring for this fight. You're not fit enough. And that is when the doubts will start. And it wouldn't surprise me, because Lewis is known as being, was being laid back. He'd have a little nap in the dressing room, then he'd have a little dance to his music. But it wouldn't surprise me if Lewis, in the moments before he stepped foot to do his ring walk, he was having a little word with himself saying, I'm not quite right for this.
Even despite a little bit of Bob Marley coaxing him towards the ring as part of his ring walk music. This promotion, Matt, on HBO stateside, Cedric Kushner, the South African-born, American-based promoter, was part of it. And this, we'll have to do something on him, one pod, Cedric Kushner. Interesting character. A lot of it tied in to some of the heavyweights, including Rachman. There is a, I mentioned it before in the pod a few years ago. There's a documentary that you can find on YouTube that is about Cedric Kushner, and it follows a few of the storylines, including one with Rachman, where Rachman gets poached by Don King, and there's a bit of that dealt with in the in that documentary. So I did mention it on the pod. I can't remember the name of it, but I'll dig it out. But you'll be able to Google it and YouTube it, Cedric Kushner documentary. And there is a bit of that Rachman poach by Don King with a bag of cash. That's included in that. And I think Rachman would go with Don King after this fight. The backdrop to this actually taking place, Matt, is the fact that Lennox Lewis versus Mike Tyson had been put on ice, hadn't it? Because Tyson, after his fight the year previous with Andrew Gullotta, had failed that drugs test for marijuana, and he'd been on a 3-month suspension. Tyson, so that kind of Tyson Lewis, they'd been trying to make that through 2000/2001, and that's why Rachman had kind of been jettisoned in, because Tyson couldn't be there, and Tyson would be the following year.
I remember this era really well. Yeah, it was a fight everybody wanted to see. And the announcement of Hassan Rachman isn't what fans particularly wanted. Probably blaming Lennox Lewis for it a little bit as well. Because it's odd when you go back. And when Boxing News produced that bookazine, and I spent an awful lot of time going back over old reports about Lennox Lewis, and it's shocking how underappreciated he was while he was essentially largely invincible at the top of the heavyweight division in a really good era. But yeah, everybody wanted to see him fight Mike Tyson. And you compare Hassan Rachman to Mike Tyson as a spectacle, and of course, you're going to be disappointed. And that, I think, also kind of played into Lennox Lewis's thoughts. There is no question whatsoever that he would have been appearing in Ocean's 11 if Mike Tyson had been his opponent on the 22nd of April 2001.
No, and the fight itself, it's not a great fight in truth. The fight itself, Lewis, you can see either affected by his preparation and or the altitude. As early as the third round, Matt, mouth open, gulping in air, isn't he? And Rachman probably not helping with that deliberate policy of stabbing jabs to the body right from the very start. Good tactic that from Rachman. And it might well have played its part. Although in round five, when the fight finishes, it looks like Lennox is just starting to grab control, and he's just starting to assert. He's just being a bit more aggressive, Matt, isn't he? And then he gets lopped with a right hand, one of the biggest punches of the fight to that point. Rachman bounces a right hand off his cheek, and then Lewis retreats, drops his hand. There's a bit of poking the tongue out and play acting. And in that moment, there is a visible lowering of the physical and the mental defences, isn't there? He backs off against the rope, sticks his tongue out, and literally you can see it, both physically and mentally importantly. He switches off and the defences come down. And then it reminds me exactly of Froch Groves 2. Carl Froch steps across and then steps into the right hand. And it's almost an identical finish, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a spectacular finish, and I think what Lewis said afterwards highlights where he was mentally. He said, he said it in the immediate aftermath. He said, "I can't believe that. I just can't believe it. I felt fine in there. I was going about my work nice and comfortably, and there was no way that someone like Hasim Rahman could beat me." He's saying that after the fight, and that's obviously what he believed. He thought it was enough. Full credit to Hasim Rahman. That was his Buster Douglas moment, and that is still referenced now. You obviously have at the top of the pile Douglas beating Tyson, perhaps then Holyfield beating Tyson, Jimmy Braddock beating Max Baer, and then you've got your Ali beating Foreman, but then in the chasing pack then, you've got this particular result. It was. Lewis was such a good champion. But as I said, there were so many grumbles and whispers and moans that this might happen. So many warnings. One of Lewis's handlers had a dream that Lennox Lewis was going to get knocked out because he was just racked with worry that Lewis wasn't right for this fight.
And that Ali Foreman upset referenced by one of the lines from Larry Merchant, where he said of Lewis, "It's a crumble in the jungle," said Merchant, adding, "We have a new heavyweight champion and he's from the United States." So there was an element of jingoism stroke patriotism from them all. George Foreman starts to hum the national anthem as part of the HBO team as well. It gives you an idea, kind of, Matt, of the context and maybe a bit of perspective on the timing of this as a result and in the heavyweight division itself.
Yeah, I mean, that historically, the heavyweight championship is the property of an American fighter. Historically, the vast majority of heavyweight champions, particularly when there's only one of them, would be Americans. Now it's completely different, but there was a discussion around this time, I'm not sure it was before this fight or after this fight, where people were starting to ask questions as to why more Americans were not in and amongst it in the heavyweight division like they used to be. And I think we've seen that become more pronounced as time has gone on. There was people talk about it because Deontay Wilder really has been the only American in recent years, hasn't he? Whereas giants once grew up to be boxers, giants were then growing up to be American footballers. They were growing up to go and play basketball or baseball or whatever. And I think there is still an issue over in America about how they're going to restore that golden age. I think it's long gone, but this was kind of the early stages of it around the time of this fight.
Mad to think that Rahman would still be fighting a decade and more later, bumping into Alex Povetkin at the end of his career in 2012. Whereas for Lennox, it was the closing chapters of a historic career, wasn't it? He'd hammer Rahman in four in the rematch 7 months later. The next year, Mike Tyson in eight in 2002. And then he'd be out for a year before he came back for substitute opponent Vitaly Klitschko. And that was the fight that showed Lewis the door.
It did. And I think you could say that he wisely chose against having a rematch with Vitaly Klitschko. But the fact that he beat Vitaly Klitschko, when one considers that previous champions would lose to their successor, like Joe Lewis losing to Rocky Marciano, like Muhammad Ali losing to Larry Holmes, Lewis beat his, which I think was the perfect way to end his career. And it gets even better as time progresses and we went on to see what happened after Lennox Lewis. And there was something in last week's Boxing News where there has been no heavyweight in history who left such an almighty hole behind that has proved unfillable ever since Lewis walked away as Lennox Lewis. We're still waiting. Hopefully we get it next month, don't we? When Usyk and Fury collide. But we are still waiting for that one champion to return.
And we're going to be building up to that big fight and an historic one in the coming weeks here on The Opening Bell. And if you want to follow us, then make sure that you go and search for The Opening Bell podcast wherever you get it, because you will have to refollow, resubscribe on our new feed. So we're moving on to a new feed, but it will be your regular outlet, whether it's Amazon, whether it's Spotify, or whether it's iTunes. You will be able to get it and download it each week from the same place, but you will have to follow and subscribe for us again. So you will have to follow and subscribe again, but you'll be able to do that later this week or the start of next week, at your leisure, and then it will download each and every week. And a reminder, we are looking out for sponsors. We may well have to turn on the adverts at some stage, but we'll see about that. We'll talk about all of that in the coming weeks. But if you want to sponsor us, get in touch with us. theopeningbellpodcast@gmail.com, openingbellpod on Twitter. Follow us anyway, and make sure you go and re-follow us on the new feed, wherever you get it. Thanks for your continued support. Speak to you again next week. Bye for now.